Making a Difference, a Junction Journalism production. I'm Sophie Norris, and this episode of Making a Difference has been produced by journalism students at Charles Sturt University, located on Wiradjuri country. Over the past few weeks, my fellow students and I have been reporting on the big issues affecting our country, and more specifically, what impacts these have on our local region of Bathurst and the Central West. First up in the program, Cody Mildwater gives us the buzz on what is happening with the varroa mite and what this means for bees and local beekeepers.
Just when we had thought we had heard the end of quarantine and lockdown, these two hot topics have been popping back up in our news, this time for bees. Varroa mites are small mites that live on bees and in their hives, which has caused big issues for bee-reliant industries in the rest of the world. These mites have entered the country for the first time following a serious breach of our strict border biosecurity laws. They were first detected in Newcastle and have spread across the state of New South Wales. Hobby beekeepers are now being asked to keep an eye on their bees for this pervasive species. I'm currently joined by a local beekeeper to get some more information about how to help fight off this parasite. So, how do varroa mites actually impact beehives and bees?
Varroa mites work to destroy hives by taking over the cells where bee larvae are growing, and over time this can stop the growth of the hive and cause it to collapse.
What can people who have beehives in their backyards do to help beekeepers during this time and help to reduce the spread?
The first step is to check what zone you are in. There are blue, yellow, purple and red, with red being the most serious. If you are in a red zone, you cannot interact with your bees at all unless directly instructed by a Department of Primary Industries officer.
And what about for people outside of these red zones?
Anyone in an emergency zone is not allowed to feed their bees unless they are using a special bee feeding device that is installed on beehives.
So, can beekeepers remove honey from their hives?
There are strict rules about who can remove honey from their hives. If you want to know if you are allowed, the best way to find out is through the department's page where they have the rules.
What is the best way for hobbyist beekeepers to check for varroa mites in their hives?
There are two main ways beekeepers can check for mites. The first is what we call a sugar shake test. And basically, you get some bees, put them in a container with some small holes in the top with some icing sugar, roll the container around so the bees are covered in, and then shake the sugar out into some water. What happens is the sugar dislodges the mites from the bees and allows them to drop into the water. And you can see if your bees have mites. This doesn't hurt the bees and lets you check if they have mites.
And are our native beehives also impacted by these mites?
No, so far we don't think that our native bees have been impacted by the mites.
If you have honeybees in your backyard and want to find out more information about how to help keep our honeybees safe, the Department of Primary Industries has a form you can fill out to receive the most up-to-date information about varroa mites and the changing conditions of the issue.
In keeping with the theme of plagues and pandemics, our reporter Archie Staines breaks down what is happening with foot and mouth disease and how this may impact the rural agricultural sector.
Farmers from across the nation are bracing for a pandemic of biblical proportions. Foot and mouth disease has already seen millions of livestock deaths across the globe and has most recently been detected spreading in Indonesia. The Australian government is highly concerned about the lethal disease and are preparing for the worst. Viral fragments were found in Chinese pork products within a Melbourne supermarket within the last week, forcing measures to wash shoes at international airports for those entering from Indonesia. Minister for Agriculture and Member for Dubbo, Dugald Saunders, says he is very concerned about the situation and recently held an important press conference at the Department of Primary Industries building in Orange, where the disease is being monitored.
So beefing up surveillance is one of the really important ways that we can make sure we know if something comes in, where it gets to very, very quickly and lock it down very, very quickly.
State government funding has been announced to ramp up surveillance in the Central West area.
So this money will go towards a couple of things. First of all, really importantly, to try and keep things at bay. The best result is to not get these diseases into Australia. So ramping up surveillance is one way we do that.
Central West farmers warn of a wool and meat price rise if the virus takes hold, with the government now discussing possible travel bans to be put in place with tourist hotspot Indonesia. Farming land makes up approximately 93% of the Central West and is one of the main economic forces in the region. The new virus threat casting a grim outlook for farmers.
The team is here on hand, very quickly responding and assessing the situation.
While Australia is still disease-free, the federal government estimates a major outbreak could cost upwards of $80 billion and last for months, if not years.
Things like foot and mouth disease, all of the things that can impact our primary industries, but also our regional communities and, in fact, industry as a whole.
Humans can get foot and mouth disease, but in some good news, experts say it's very rare and does not result in serious disease.
This is Making a Difference, a Junction Journalism production produced by journalism students at Charles Sturt University. With foot and mouth ramping up, there is no better time to contribute to sustaining the agricultural sector. Talia Tranter interrogates the importance of studying and finding a career in agriculture.
Throughout the coronavirus pandemic, climate change crisis, and now infectious diseases on the rise, the agriculture industry has taken significant hits over the past few years. According to the Department of Education, Skills and Employment, agriculture has one of the highest unemployment rates within the Central West due to there not being enough people wanting to contribute to the industry. Coordinator of Agriculture for the Scots College, Daisy Thomas, says young people are the answer to the agriculture industry's increasing problems.
We need to educate our young people about how they can be involved in these exciting careers, you know, the ones that really draw them in, the really fun, technology-heavy, subjects and areas, to bridge the gap between what is happening in the country in innovation and technology and what is known to be happening. I think that these are the students who are going to be able to do it, because we haven't encountered scenarios like this before in our lifetime. I think it's the people of tomorrow that are really going to come up with the solutions.
Ms. Thomas says with significant issues coming into Australia, young people have the opportunity to use innovation and research to find solutions.
I think that it's an exciting space. I really do think in Australia it's probably the most exciting space that's happening. We've got so many issues at the moment, even if you look at the varroa mite and foot and mouth disease and looking at biosecurity and how that can be managed. We've got growing populations. We've got issues with food security worldwide. We've got these floods and fires and Europe burning. And we've got all these incredible issues that are just unprecedented. And these are the kids that are going to be part of coming up with the solutions.
There is hope for more students to study in the Central West to be able to explore a variety of areas within the agricultural sector.
There are 4 to 5 jobs for every agricultural graduate. So every student that goes to university and graduates in the ag area, it could be ag business, ag science, you know, vet science, any sort of industry that links in with agriculture. 5 jobs is huge. You know, you look at the engineering industry and they're struggling to find jobs when they come out of university. But agriculture is screaming for people.
13.6% of employment is made up of the agricultural sector in the Central West. In 2021, New South Wales recorded its primary industry's estimated total output of $20.9 billion. Agriculture is an industry in need of employment to maintain a sustainable nation.
I obviously am aware of the shortage of workers, and I suppose we need to be really appealing to them to choose it as a subject at school and as a university degree to then translate that into people working, you know, higher up in the industry.
Still on the theme of pandemics, with COVID-19 cases ramping up again, especially in the regions, Joe Richards gives us insight into the GP shortage happening in rural and regional areas and what we can do about it.
The national GP shortage is reaching an all-new breaking point. Although metropolitan areas are facing long wait times and other issues, it is the regional areas that are being hit the hardest. In New South Wales, average GP waiting times have reached 4.17 days. New South Wales has the highest waiting times out of any state in the country. Professor Karen Price, president of the Royal College of General Practitioners, detailed that regional doctors have to have a specific set of skills.
So we're trying to understand how we can help, how we can make it a great experience for rural doctors to keep wanting to come back and back and back. So that's the idea, is to give them a great experience, a wonderful challenge and a wonderful career.
The crisis has gotten dire to the point where leaders of the Royal College had a meeting with rural GPs in Alice Springs, which is arguably one of the areas that have been affected the most by the shortage. This meeting was to talk to local GPs, get a feel for how the regions are dealing with the crisis, and to formulate solutions to the crisis.
Well, we're here to listen and learn regarding the local workforce issues and more broadly what's required from the college as we take back on profession-led training, what sort of cultural immersion we need to do, we're going to learn about from our Indigenous leaders. And basically find out a bit more about what the local ground on, you know, intelligence is regarding workforce issues.
As a third wave of the coronavirus and flu season looms near, Professor Price says that the government needs to take action to alleviate the effects of the shortage.
The government needs to face fairly and squarely what unfortunately has happened over the last couple of decades, which is defunding relative to every other specialty and to the CPI of general practice. By doing that, what happens is those costs get pushed forward into hospitals. We see the crisis at the moment. So we need to have general practice the career of choice. We've only got 15% of our new graduates wanting to do general practice, and the target should be 50%. The government needs to face fairly and squarely what unfortunately has happened over the last couple of decades, which is defunding relative to every other specialty and to the CPI of general practice. By doing that, what happens is those costs get pushed forward into hospitals. We see the crisis at the moment. So we need to have general practice the career of choice. We've only got 15% of our new graduates wanting to do general practice, and the target should be 50%.
Now, it's not just health practitioners and patients who are still impacted by COVID. Rather, many small businesses are still struggling to get staff after the last 2 years' lockdowns. Susie Cornford has the story.
The impact of COVID-19 has been widespread and ongoing. Local business owners in Bathurst continue to struggle with staff shortages daily. In the last month, the Bathurst region has reported 1,980 cases, which translates to 123 per 1,000 person. We talked to a local business owner from the hospitality district about the impact of COVID-19 and staff shortages on his business.
Since COVID, a lot of people have left our industry. It's been a real struggle to keep a lot of those businesses, although the government subsidies did help, they still transferred to different positions. Some days it makes it very hard with a staff member out sick to be able to open and operate efficiently and to maintain a good level of customer service.
According to the Bathurst Regional Council Economic Profile, in 2016, 1,282 people worked in hospitality. Additionally, the report states that in 2019 and 2020, the industry contributed $6.1 million to the Bathurst economy. With staff shortages, small businesses often find it difficult to stay open at all.
We've closed several times. We tried to stay open during the lockdowns, which worked, but then coming out of lockdowns, we had staff out, no staff available. Yeah, we've had plenty of days we've closed due to no staff. We are running with a very skeleton crew to a point that it's very hard.
Small businesses are having to put preventative measures into place to prepare for the effects of growing COVID cases.
We've reduced hours of staff working so that if someone is out sick, the others will sort of help carry the load. We also have hired staff, but not all staff are available every day.
COVID-19 is not the only factor contributing to staff shortages, making it even more difficult for small businesses to stay open.
Well, you've got the cost of childcare is going up, wages are going up, so you're having to pay more for the staff. The customers are coming in with their expectations that they're waited on hand and foot, and it doesn't always work and doesn't always relate to how the service style is.
Evidently, COVID-19 and its impact of staff shortages is still evident in the hospitality district. It's important to remember these struggles when interacting with staff, especially of small businesses.
You're listening to Making a Difference, a Junction Journalism production. This episode is produced by journalism students at Charles Sturt University. In terms of trying to emerge better after COVID lockdowns, Eden Peruri investigates just how hard it is for Australians to access tradespeople and their supplies.
New South Wales residents are struggling to conduct building works on their homes amidst the limited supply of tradespeople and raw materials. Supply issues have affected most areas of Australia and have caused month-long delays for construction and upgrade work on both new and existing homes. The labour shortage has placed a hold on Australia's post-COVID resurgence, and the lack of materials like wood and steel products needed to build and renovate may still be months away. For new builds, there have been reports of construction being delayed by up to a year and often results in unexpected bills for the rising costs of building materials. These shortages are severely impacting rural areas where access to workers and resources is already sparse. The Australian Bureau of Statistics' most recent release found that there has been an increase of more than 100% in Australian job vacancies since February 2020. It's not only tradespeople that are sorely missing from rural areas. Agriculture, hospitality, aged and disability care, and cleaning vacancies are leaving a gap in struggling rural businesses. In reaction to widespread shortages, the Albanese government has this week begun to prioritise processing 60,000 permanent visa applications in a bid to fill urgent job placements across the country. New homeowner Michael Coates purchased a property in a remote section of the Mid-North Coast during COVID and has been waiting for over 6 months for construction to begin on his property.
There seems to be a lot of work, so getting hold of tradesmen can be quite difficult. And with that comes the idea that tradesmen can charge themselves out quite expensively, and sometimes due to the lack of other tradesmen in the market, you can kind of be stuck.
Would you be able to source materials and conduct renovations yourself?
You could, but material at the moment is quite expensive as well due to COVID. So, you know, what might have cost you for a bathroom if pre-COVID would have, you know, now is about three times the price. So say you're doing a bathroom for $5,000, it's now 15, but that's based on raw materials, really.
There's no telling when supply may meet demand. As COVID-related travel and migration rules ease, a supply of international job seekers may provide relief to the struggling industry of rural towns. However, there seems to be no deadline in sight for the delivery of desperately needed raw materials.
Living in a digital age, we all take fast internet for granted. Our reporter Christian Penny visits one of the 12 regional schools who have just upgraded to fibre connection internet, which is up to 20 times faster than their previous satellite connection.
Wattle Flat Primary School is just one of 12 across New South Wales regions that have transitioned from satellite internet to a more stable and reliable fibre connection. Minister for Education Sarah Mitchell said the government's invested more than $320 million to ensure the country kids have the same access to learning opportunities as their city counterparts.
We know that we live in a digital world. We know it's so important for our students to really invest in technology. And what this means is that public schools right across New South Wales will have the fastest and most reliable internet of any public school system in the country.
Part of the $320 million investment is in new technology for schools, including computers and smart boards. For teachers and staff, it couldn't come sooner.
Prior to the changeover to fibre, we were working on a very antiquated satellite system, which often failed. I found myself coming to school 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning to get onto the computers to do the work before other schools got onto the bandwidth.
The government's partnered with Telstra for the rollout and maintenance of the services, Telstra saying the partnership was proof of its commitment to investing in infrastructure across the community. The investment is part of the government's strategy to close the digital divide in the regional access gap.
The state of roads around the country are at a low standard due to frequent floods resulting in deep potholes. I investigated how a new pothole repair machine could be the secret to reducing pothole frequency in Bathurst, and if successful, could be mimicked by councils all around the country. The state of Bathurst roads are at an all-time low, with potholes to be found on almost every street in town. But even despite this fact, a pothole fixing machine has been left out of Bathurst Regional Council's budget for a fifth year in a row. However, the machine's biggest advocate isn't giving up hope just yet. Bathurst Regional Councillor Warren Orban has been lobbying for a machine for 5 years and says the current methods are archaic.
When I first brought it up, I was told we've already got one of those. And when I went in and did some checking, The one that we actually have was acquired from the Evans Shire days. That's now 15 years ago, and the pothole machine was old then. So we're looking at a prehistoric thing that's, burnt out, doesn't do the job.
One only needs to take a trip to Chifley Dam to see it is almost near impossible to avoid the potholes, even more so if a car is driving the other way. Perhaps even Research Station Drive at the uni. It is impossible to get from point A to point B without buckling your wheel at least once. Residents and citizens of Bathurst are calling for a more permanent solution, like David Highland, the president of Bathurst Cycling Club.
Look, I think the council probably needs to take a longer-term view of to look at the quality of the road surface and think about what needs to be done to improve the road so that it doesn't break up, to fix it in a way that it can stay intact for a longer period of time so that less frequent repairs are needed.
Cycle enthusiasts like David are at greater risk in competitions and are at risk of losing the events being held in Bathurst altogether.
So I think as a bigger picture issue, if we want to continue to hold open events and things, we want the roads to be in the best condition that they can be in.
Whilst the council claims it has inadequate funding, when crunching the numbers with Mr. Orban, it wasn't difficult to see the value of such equipment to Bathurst. Council spends approximately $500,000 on pothole repairs every year, which is equivalent to the cost of buying the machine. But this amount would be easily made back with increased time and staff efficiency, with the machine requiring only 2 workers max.
Really, these machines are designed to pull up on top of a pothole, hazard lights on, and do the job, and it takes a couple of minutes to actually do a pothole, and traffic can just go normally around them, and they're pretty much a one-man band.
Proving his point even further, Mr. Orban has himself located a pothole machine that can fix potholes in under 10 minutes. Better yet, the dealer is located in Forbes. Mr. Orban says his goal is to convince council to trial the machine prior to purchase. Whilst there is no chance of inclusion in the 2022 and 2023 budget, the machine is set to be trialled later this year. Continuing with transport, Noah Seckham discusses the demand from regional residents for better parking, especially in Bathurst.
The future development of Bathurst has been outlined in a new report brought before local council this month. The future-proofing Bathurst CBD report has established the leading focus of development for the area in the next few years, addressing public art spaces, public transport, building height limits, residential opportunities and pedestrian accessibility. However, top of the list was and is parking. This blaring contradiction to the rest of the list was hotly debated in the public forum, with equal parts asking for more parking and others arguing against the priority afforded to personal vehicle infrastructure. Councillor Marg Hogan says the focus of road infrastructure has been tailored to suit the area as a transitional measure and to cater to all residents.
I think there has to be a balance of both. I personally live 3 blocks from the CBD, and I'm uncomfortable riding a bicycle into the centre of the city. I think that needs to change. We have to find solutions to get people onto bicycles or to make it very easy for people to walk around the city. Having said that, I'm also conscious that we have a lot of people that come in from the suburbs and from the outlying villages who are reliant on cars. So we have to balance.
The heritage conservation in the Bathurst CBD also provides some limitation to the future development opportunities. Finding a use for some of Bathurst's notoriously difficult buildings, such as the old TAFE facility, remain vague. The term adaptive use has been thrown around with no guaranteed future outlined.
I think if you go to many of the great cities or big regional towns and cities of the world, those that do it well hold on to the best of the past, but they are able to create new buildings in a contemporary way. I don't see why there can't be a place for both.
It is hoped the draft future-proofing plan will serve as a point of reference for future developments within the CBD.
In 100 years' time, I would hope people might reflect back and say, you know what, the people who were thinking about this 100 years ago were really on the right track. That's what, my vision, my personal vision for Bathurst would be.
The Bathurst Fast Train is set to reopen in the coming weeks after railway lines were damaged by floods. Duck Wilson reports on what this means for regional tourism and what we can do to ensure it doesn't close again next time it floods.
the main Western Railway line is set to reopen to passenger services, including the Bathurst Bullet, on Saturday 30th of July, 2 weeks ahead of schedule.
The Bathurst Bullet is an important transport link for people travelling from the central west and the regions of Bathurst, Orange, Blaney, Oberon, Lithgow as well, using that that rail service getting through to Sydney.
This result comes after repair teams worked around the clock to repair a landslide near Mount Victoria, which had closed the line between there and Katoomba for several weeks.
After the hard work from our Transport for New South Wales crews, we're going to see passenger services resume from the 30th of July. That is 2 weeks earlier than anticipated.
Minister for Regional Transport and Roads Sam Faraway spoke to us last Friday, where he said he was extremely pleased to see the important railway line restored.
This really should be to the credit of the Transport for New South Wales crews. So we will see freight moving along the line overnight from the 24th and then from the 30th of July, with signalling and both lines back in operation and that infrastructure being reinstated, we will see 100% capacity or moving towards 100% capacity of that line in only a week or so's time.
John Hollis from Rail Action Bathurst and former Bathurst Mayor Monica Morse concurred.
Well, of course, it's always good to be able to return and restore the routine so that the community has certainty and the community can plan their trips.
Oh, it's extremely advantageous. There are now two bullets. One leaves very early and then one leaves at about 7:35. Coming back from Katoomba about a month ago, service provided was a school bus, which was absolutely crowded with people from Katoomba to Lithgow to Bathurst, and it was people standing up all the way, no facilities for luggage and no toilet. It was really, really bad service. Yes, I am pleased to see it restored.
The reopening of the line means through passenger trains from Sydney to Lithgow, Bathurst, Dubbo and Broken Hill can resume. Freight services will also be restarting, and Mr Faraway said this was important for the various food, grain and mining industries that rely on the railway to transport their goods.
Really important industries that support a lot of jobs in the region, and it's been good to be able to get this rail infrastructure opened back to capacity much earlier that will support those industries and support those jobs.
The first Sydney to Bathurst train will be the Saturday XPT service to Dubbo, followed that evening by the Bathurst Bullets, whilst the first Bathurst to Sydney service will be the XPT on Saturday 30th, followed by the Bullets on the morning of July 31st.
And that story by Duck Wilson finishes our program. For more of the best stories in student journalism around Australia, go to our website, junctionjournalism.com. And don't forget, there's a new episode of Making a Difference every month. You can subscribe on your favourite podcast app. I'm Sophie Norris, and thanks for listening.